Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Connolly, Judge Smith, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding. Judge Werke, you're muted.
That's going to happen. I was going to say in my opening remarks that I would ask you to mute yourself unless you're speaking. And of course, I'm speaking and I'm muted. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. These hearings are being conducted today, September 9, 2020, via video and audio. I can see the attorneys that are present. You will notice that Judge Tracy Smith shows as a blank screen. She's had some technical difficulties, but she can clearly hear you and is participating in these proceedings. The rules of appellate procedure remain the same as they do if we were conducting these hearings at the Minnesota Judicial Center. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
This is case number A19-1876, Matthew James Olness Petitioner Appellant versus Jill Marie Olness, now known as Jill Marie Stefano Respondent.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready to begin, you can unmute yourself and begin your argument.
May it please the court. My name is John Burns and I represent the appellant, Matthew Olness. This appeal arises out of a post-decreed divorce matter. The parties were divorced 3 years ago on September 8, 2017. At that time, Mr. Olness was employed by Cook Medical as a district sales manager, and he had an average gross monthly income of nearly $14,000. Respondent was self-employed as a hairstylist and with some additional nominal imputed income, had a total income at that point of $1,495 per month. And against these two income levels, the parties stipulated to an award of $5,000 per month in spousal maintenance for 60 months. A major source of Mr. Olness's income at the time of the divorce was his commission income from Cook Medical's drug-eluting stent. It was the only product of its type on the market from 2013 through 2018. But that changed last year. In January of 2019, the Federal Drug Administration opened an investigation into Cook Medical's product. Also in 2019, in January, another company brought a competing product to market. As a result, Cook Medical's sales dropped by over $10 million in 2019 on this product. The loss of income was also felt by appellant. For the first 6 months of 2019, Mr. Olness's income for work performed that year dropped by nearly 25%.
Counsel, can I ask, this is Judge Smith. Yes. So at the time of the hearing on this motion to modify, the amount of the bonus for 2019 was not yet known. Is that right?
That is correct. And that, Okay. Yes. So that was an issue. There was a bonus received, Your Honor, in the amount of $9,724. Which it's unrefuted that that was for performance and work done in 2018. Paid.
So why is it right? So the 2018 bonus was known and then included in the income for purposes of measuring against the 13,978. Yes. But with respect to 2019, why is it an abuse of discretion for the district court to say it is yet unknown? It is premature to know the fall of 2019, what the income for 2019 is going to be if the 2019 bonus is not yet determined?
For two reasons. The standard that the court used in looking at the 2019 bonus was a zero possibility standard. The court created that on their own and questioned if there was a zero possibility that it could be earned. And Mr. Olness could not say there was a zero possibility.
So what is the right possibility? If we're if one is speculating or even informed speculation as to what a bonus is going to be, what is a district court, what is the standard then for determining when it's not yet in fact determined what the bonus is?
Thank you. And that's a key portion of our argument. It is a dependable source. That's the language, not zero possibility, but dependable source. And on page 10 of my brief, I lay that out, and I provide the Haskin case, where in that case, there had been a bonus history up to $9,000. And the other side was arguing that that bonus level of up to $9,000 should be considered as income moving forward. But the court analyzed that the future bonuses were not a dependable source for that case. And that same analysis should apply here. The intervening events are critical. There's the FDA investigation.
Right, but Mr. Byrd, I mean, I understand the difference between that case and this case, but the, but following up on Judge Schmidt's excellent question, I mean, the FDA could drop its investigation and the other product could somehow fail. So unless, and so that's a possibility. So rather than sort of, you know, why would we want to reverse the district court for doing what it did now? If those two things happen, and then he does get his bonus, and then the other side's going to come in and say, well, he got his bonus. Right. I mean, isn't this premature? I mean, why can't we just wait? And if he doesn't get his bonus, well, then that would be the time to move for modification, because, you know, he's not going to get his bonus. And then we've got COVID and all the rest of this stuff. Right. So I guess I'm not so sure why we would want to penalize the district court for making a decision that, you know, seems logical, and, you know, whereas your arguments seem to be, while maybe it's likely going to happen, it's still not clear that it will, and in any event, might be premature.
Well, if we were to analyze it that way, then an obligor would have to wait for the entire year to pass, all of 2019, and you know, he's qualified. Because his reduction in base income exceeds the 20%, he's qualified now. And so what he's asking the court to do is to make a modification or an elimination of his maintenance obligation now.
The so court Mr. Burns, if that happened, following up on my colleague's comments, if that happened, and in fact, your motion was granted, it would have been effective from the date that you filed your motion. And if it turned out to be the converse, then wife would have been harmed and would have to come back to court and ask to have reinstatement. I mean, there needs to be some judicial efficiency here. My question to you after that statement is simply asking you if there's any reason you can't come back to court now, or you could come back to court for the pending appeal and say, look, I didn't get my 2019 bonus. I mean, you weren't prohibited from doing that, were you?
No, not at all. So,
if you did that now, are you precluded from having retroactivity of the commencement of that reduction?
Yes, we would be, because this effort was denied.
Isn't that then a legal maneuver that your client chose, that he could either move early in anticipation of getting the bonus or waiting until it was done so that he would have a proper start date for the modification?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it was not a legal maneuver. It was 6 months of hardship. He had 6 months where he was down nearly 25% in income. He had an expectation that it was going to continue. The FDA investigations traditionally, And even our district court judge identified some knowledge with that area, take a long time. And in fact, I'll leave it at that. But he's asking for the retroactivity. You know, the respondent was being compensated based upon a level of ability to pay that my client simply did not have. And so one of the things we offered the court was to say, if a bonus is received, if something changes, my client would have an affirmative obligation to notify the other side, to notify the court. This judicial economy concern in maintenance cases where we're talking about a large award, I would argue, are something that could be monitored. If the court said you're down 25%, I'm going to reduce the maintenance obligation, and then I want everybody to come back for a review hearing. We do that all the time. Or I'm going to reduce it, and I'm going to require some documentation. We do it all the time. So respectfully, I would say that the better course of action for the court is to follow the statute. And the statute clearly identifies that the judge is supposed to, under Minnesota statute 518A.39, subdivision 2E, look at the circumstances, and here's the key, at the time of the motion. The circumstances at the time of the motion for my client are that he had no bonus, that he had a base income that was down nearly 25%, that he had no expectation of a bonus moving forward.
Can you explain? I need a little help understanding that a little bit more. So at the time of the motion, it was his base salary plus then the 2018 bonus that would then be included in his 2019's compensation, right?
Well, that is correct.
Okay.
And the effect of that, of taking a bonus, which should have been extrapolated over 12 months and putting it instead over 6 months, is to really double the effect and the hit of that bonus.
So I do want to ask your opposing counsel about that, because that does seem to be a mistake. And I want to understand why it's not, if that's the position. So a 12 months bonus for 2018 distributed across, excuse me, a bonus for 2018 distributed across all 12 months of 2019. As we looked at it, seemed still, if you look at that income, still not to reduce beyond 20%. I mean, to us, it looked like that would be a monthly of $11,373, right, which is less than 20% change. So I have a question about that. And then secondly, then we get to the question of you're saying, yeah, and we should consider a zeroing bonus for 2019, right? So right, you have a question about the distribution of 2018, and then you're saying it must be zero for 2019. This district court abuses discretion in thinking otherwise. Right. And that's how you get to 20%, is only, so when you're saying he's down, it's because you assume there will be nothing for 2019, even though he would not receive it until 2020, right?
That is correct. So we don't assume that. What the statute requires is that you look at what are your actual circumstances when you're in there arguing the motion. And in July of 2019, he has zero 2019 bonus. And in July of 2019, he has base income and total income that's down 25%. And so he was entitled to, as a matter of law, applying that statute, a modification. Now, whether that modification happened in one part and then a second part, whether it was subject to some verification, you know, all of those are relevant, but you have to look at the present circumstances.
Right, but he would always, whether he expected a 2019 bonus or not, it would always be zero at the time before December 2019, whenever he's informed of what it is, right?
No, not at all.
No?
Presumably, if he was in front of the court and his company hadn't lost $10 million on that product, didn't have an FDA investigation, and there hadn't been a competitor's product that had just come on the market, if you didn't have those factors, then it would be impossible to argue that I don't expect to get a similar or the same bonus the next year. But those current factors have to be considered in looking at the current situation. And the failure to do that, the closing your eyes to what's happening and saying, unless you can tell me there's a zero possibility of a bonus, shifts the burden too heavily to my client and ignores the correct standard that is supposed to be applied in these situations. In addition to punishing my client solely for this side, the court failed to hold the respondent to an expectation that she was becoming self supporting, and that she was in a five-year maintenance obligation, working her way towards that self-supporting analysis that needed to occur. And again, by failing to expect that of her, when we brought the motion, you take a snapshot of where both parties are at. And my client's situation, we argue, he satisfies his obligation to get his foot in the door. His income has gone down. His ability to pay has gone down. When you analyze the other side of the equation, there's this statement that I don't have to do anything. And that's incorrect. Because
can I ask you, counsel, if your client hadn't had a reduction in compensation, as you argue, would you have a basis for, in the circumstances that we're here, which was 5 years of maintenance agreed to, could you just go in after two and say, well, here's the, wife hasn't done enough to earn income, I want a reduction because of that. Like, what obligates her in the context of this case and this agreement, subject to, you know, a modification to increase her income?
I'll answer that. I see my time is almost expired, but let me answer that question. We would not have brought the motion independently. I think that if my client's income hadn't triggered a statutory analysis under 518A, if we didn't come in under his change of circumstances, I don't think we get a look at how she's doing in her progress. I don't think we can come in and say, you should be further along. As long as she ultimately gets, you know, there, that's going to be the analysis at the five-year mark. Did you do enough? So respectfully, I don't think as an independent analysis that we would have succeeded. But there's a requirement that we have to look at her need once we get our foot in the door. And respectfully, that's what I'm identifying as the second error from the district court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burns. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Rosalyn Ardon and I'm counsel for the respondent, Ms. Stefano. This matter has been pending for over a year. And one of the issues to me is that at any time, the appellant could have returned to district court if in fact the issues with respect to speculation were met. This is a case where not only do we feel that the factors in the modification statute are not met, but also there are some misstatements concerning the income side. And I want to address Justice Smith's questions. If you look at the exhibit, which is in index number 42, exhibit A, that is the pay stub from the end of June of 2019. What it reflects is, first of all, a base salary that in fact has increased since the time of the stipulated findings on income. And if in fact the company, and in particular, Mr. Onus's compensation was being impacted, why wouldn't that have been decreased? There's also the second category of commission income. That is paid on a monthly basis. There is in fact commission income being paid, which one would think then means that there is a product or products from which Mr. Onus benefits when sold that are generating that additional income to him.
I have a question for you on the determination of that stipulated amount. As I understand it, salary was factored and then the commission, as it had accrued in the preceding year, paid every month, right?
Correct.
Okay, if the inverse was true and you skip into 2019, and you started getting greater commissions, you wouldn't be able to apply for an increase in spousal maintenance, would you?
We would
not. What I'm getting at is this, you have a snapshot of what somebody is earning. So the snapshot that Mr. Olness had when there was a stipulation was earnings for a year, And then added to that, you needed to factor the commissions that had been earned in the prior year. That is that correct how it was figured?
Which is the normal way of computing a sales manager who does rely upon the three components, the base, the commission, and the bonus. All we can do in determining the issue of spousal maintenance is in fact look at an annualized income because it's a known. The commission and the bonus income are integral parts of their compensation and historically in this case and other cases has been. So that is the resource from which we need to calculate what is a fair spousal maintenance amount. And it is true in this case, we used an annualized amount that we knew. And so in fact, all three parts of that compensation were in fact utilized.
Counsel, so, I had a question. Let's say for the sake of argument, we issue an opinion in 60 days that says affirmed. And then let's also assume that he doesn't get a bonus in 2019 for all the reasons Mr. Burns indicated are likely. Can he then go back and move for a modification saying, well, I want some, you know, I want money back or I want a credit now because I never got the 2019 bonus. Is that possible?
Under court rules, Your Honor, it could only be retroactive to the actual motion document being served and filed. I would think that it would be within the trial court's discretion to factor that into its ultimate result. But in terms of court rules, it could not be a retroactive relief. Correct. Okay.
So, counsel,
well,
can
that
I ask?
That doesn't seem fair. Oh. that doesn't seem quite
agree,
fair.
Though,
so it's like, which I assume is why Mr. Burns brought the motion when he did, right?
It's very possible, but there was so much unknown. And we also, as you can tell from the transcript, had a judge who was very familiar with this sort of compensation because his wife is in the business. And so I think it was easy for him to say, there are unknowns. You're still getting paid. You're still getting commissions. A lot could happen here.
The so product- Mr. Nordain, if in fact he had filed a motion heard January 1, 2020, the decrease, if in fact he had no commissions, you agree would go back to January 1, 2020?
Correct.
There was no prohibition from him filing such a motion.
There was none, Your Honor. And it is quizzical to me that that was not the approach taken, because here we are a year later, still dealing with an order that deals with speculation. Correct.
Can you explain to me, counsel, maybe you just did and I misunderstood it, but why doesn't it appear that the district court distributed the 2018 sales bonus of $9,724 over 6 months instead of over 12? Or if it did, why do you think that's okay?
I think that the court took a year to date. You're correct. The year to date finding is actually a 12.5% reduction, not over 25. But I believe that what the court was doing was this is what we know. And there was still commission income being earned. So the trial court just said, we're taking a year to date.
So commission income, what does that have to do with how one considers the appropriate distribution of a bonus for purposes of a monthly income?
I think it was that the trial court was looking at the pattern of commission income and making an assumption that the bonus would again be paid. But you're right, mathematically, potentially that should have been a 6 month division and annualized for true math. I would agree with that. I still think that you're way short though of the 20% and factoring in all of the other factors of whether it's my client's income need, Mr. Olness's other income need, that we would be short in having the original order be unfair and unreasonable. Just because you still have to take into account whether you use a $12,000 a month average for Mr. Olness or something in the 11,000s, look at his income versus my clients, the fact that we're still working under a pre-tax or spousal maintenance award, meaning it is deductible to the payer, taxable to the payee, that it's still a fair amount, whether we annualize that bonus or not. Okay.
Ms. Counsel, if the district court had ruled the other way, said, you know what, looks like it's going south, so based on my, you know, reasonable review of the record and the assumptions, I'm going to reduce it. Would that have been an abuse of discretion?
I believe it would have under these circumstances and the amount of compensation that, in fact, he has.
Why?
Because you have to look at my client's situation. You have to look at the fact that this was a stipulated decree, the fact that Mr. Olness's income is still substantial and supports a $5,000 a month payment. All of those factors considered go to that, is it unreasonable and unfair? And under these circumstances, I do think that that would have been an abuse of discretion.
Could the judge have reserved his determination?
The court could have done that.
Implementing the amount?
The court could have done that, Your Honor, but we're not dealing with that. The court denied the motion, but it is a form of relief that would have been available.
Help my memory on these child support matters. If there was a reservation, would that be retroactive to the date that Mr. Burns filed his motion?
Technically, no. A reservation just means that the court has continuing jurisdiction. The court could have reserved with a specific finding of retroactivity, which the court did not do. Okay. And I think, Your Honor, this all boils down to the moving party in a modification of spousal maintenance has the burden. And the court was very clear in its findings that it did not feel that burden was met in showing a substantial decrease in earnings, whether it was speculating or the speculation argument, or whether it was actually using what was already on a pay stub for June at the end of June of 2019. And it also very strongly considered the fact that this was a stipulated decree where my client relies upon that source. The appellant here has brought up whether or not my client had a burden or an obligation to be self-supporting 2 years into a five-year. I think that the law is very clear that she does not have such an obligation. There's actually a review hearing built in this circumstance because of the disparity, the historical disparity in the incomes of the two parties. And so the court took that into consideration.
Does the stipulated judgment and decree require her to make an effort to attain self-sufficiency?
There is absolutely no provision in there of expectations. And under Hecker actually calls for that there are expectations set forth in the decree. And here what we have is a five-year term with no expectations and a review hearing. So I believe there is a legal argument both ways here. When the day comes, if in fact there will be a review hearing, if my client still is in need and there's still an ability to pay, I think that will be an issue for the trial court in figuring out, is this a de novo or is it a true term where there is an obligation? But in terms of expectations of where she should be 2 years or even 5 years, the decree is silent on that. I think also the appellant's argument using the Haefele case or the Haskin case, Haskin case is setting an original child support obligation and looking at whether or not a bonus should be included. And there the record shows that bonuses received by the obligor had been zero to 9,000. There's absolutely no guarantee there. Versus here, it's an important component of Mr. Olness's compensation. And so that case really doesn't apply. The the Haefeli case, there it was whether gross compensation from a closely held sub-S should be included. Again, that has nothing to do with bonuses or incentive compensation. So, you know, in this case, we have appellant's bonus income has been paid every year. It's an important part of his compensation. He would say that the change in circumstances concerning the FDA investigation, that happened in January. You know, Mr. Burns indicated both in his written submission and today, the notification of that investigation came in January of 2019, but yet commissions are still being paid, compensation is still being paid. And as we sit here today, we have no idea what the status of that is, or if there, you know, was a bonus paid. There's nothing in the record. So I think this is a case, Your Honors, where it would have been better off seeing if that bonus was paid and then bringing a motion for a change in circumstances.
Thank you for your argument. We'll turn back to you, Mr. Burns. You have the last word.
Thank you. If fairness is truly the goal, and it's good to hear counsel.
LA, just 1 minute. We need to have the timer going. There we go.
Thank you. If fairness is truly the goal, and if, you know, it's good to hear counsel say that that is the goal, then the court needs to follow the rules. And the rules say, what is your compensation the day you're there in front of me on the motion? And if the court had used that analysis and had looked at the bonus as not a zero possibility, but the dependable source analysis, then the court would have made a modification to protect,
you know,
that.
Mr. Burns, I mean, if you showed up at that hearing and your client had a letter from his employer saying no bonus this year, and the court did what it did, then I'd say, you know, that sounds like an abuse of discretion to me, because it's clear that that's not going to be a dependable source of income this year. But absent that, I guess I'm still hard pressed to understand. And, you know, the court could, I mean, I disagree with counsel for the respondent. I think it would have been reversed. I don't think it would have been abuse of discretion either. But, you know, I'm hard pressed to understand how, while the court could have done it your way and maybe, you know, common sense would have dictated it, because, you know, I don't think things are getting better now versus what happened in July of 2019. I mean, I don't know, but doesn't seem to be. But I'm not so sure I could say with a straight face that what the court did is an abuse of discretion. And that's, speaking for myself only, that's where I would have trouble writing a reversal. So why, Mr. Burns, am I wrong?
It is an abuse of discretion, respectfully, because the court did not look at and do its analysis in a snapshot of where things are at in July of 2019. In July of 2019, you have the developments with the FDA, with the competitor, and with the employer losing the income. That is clear that the court needs to focus on where they're at that time. Extrapolating a bonus that was for prior to any of those occurrences to any application for 2019, I would argue, is a reversible error. So to protect the fairness, respectfully, I think that if this were reversed and remanded back, giving the district court the power to reopen the record as they deemed fit in order to take additional evidence, it's all going to flesh out at that point. What happened, you know, the big mystery as we all sit here that we can't talk about, the 2019 bonus will become pertinent, and the retroactivity, because any other result puts the entire burden on my client. He comes in, he says, my income's down and it's not coming back. We get a chance to verify that if there's a reversal and a remand. The only way he gets the retroactivity is with a reversal and a remand. The only way that he gets relief and any other outcome is not fair to him or really just. This idea, and I come back to this as a practitioner.
Mr. Burns, wasn't that what he stipulated to? He stipulated to the annualized income. He stipulated to this base salary, and he agreed to incorporate with that the prior year's bonus. I mean, that's what he agreed to.
He agreed that at the time of the divorce, he had income of nearly $14,000, and that based upon that ability to pay, that an award of $5,000 per month in spousal maintenance was appropriate. Agreeing to that does not bar his access to come back to court if there's a modification. There's nothing in there that says, you know, there's a Karen waiver or there's some other limitation that you can't come back. He has the ability to come back, and he deserves the correct application of the statute and the case law. And that when that is done and the analysis gets performed, and I want the district court judge to have all of the factors in front of him to do this analysis.
Counsel, can I ask quickly, if I may, and I understand procedurally where we are, and I can predict the answers that we look at the time of your motion, but just apropos of the fairness argument, did he ever earn more than the stipulated amount in a given year?
He did, actually, okay. And he his income was fairly flat for the first year after the divorce. It went up a little bit in 18, but you know, I'm not arguing a fluctuation in the market. What I'm actually pointing to are these three factors beyond his control that brought us into court. For those reasons, we would ask that this be reversed and remanded back to the district court with the ability of the court to reopen the record as it deems necessary. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties for appearing in support of your party's position. The matter will be submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. You can leave the hearing.